This is the takeaway for Friday, December 1st, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks so much for being with us today on this Friday, where we have bombshell news out of Washington on the investigation into connections between the Trump campaign and Russia. Michael Flynn, President Trump's former national security advisor, has pleaded guilty to a felony, making false statements to federal investigators. According to the court filing by special counsel Robert Mueller today, Michael Flynn lied to the FBI about his contacts with Russian ambassador to the United States. Flynn resigned in February from the National Security Advisor job after the possibility of those false statements came to light. Now, you'll recall that earlier this year, former acting Attorney General Sally Yates testified before a Senate Judiciary Committee and told the panel that she tried to warn the White House about Michael Flynn, that just 6 days after President Trump took office, she told the White House counsel, told him that Flynn was lying to the vice president about his conversations with Russians, that the Russians knew it, and that the national security advisor was vulnerable to blackmail.
To state the obvious, you don't want your national security advisor compromised with the Russians.
Now, after that warning from Sally Yates to the White House, Michael Flynn remained in office for 18 more days and only lost his job after news of his false statements to the vice president broke.
You know, he was just doing his job. The thing is, he didn't tell our vice president properly, and then he said he didn't remember. So either way, it wasn't very satisfactory to me.
It wasn't very satisfactory to federal investigators either, or to a judge in federal court. Flynn is now the fourth Trump campaign official to be charged in the Mueller probe, and the first Trump White House official charged and to plead to a felony. In a statement released today after entering his guilty plea, Michael Flynn said this: after over 33 years of military service to our country, including 5 years in combat away from my family, and then my decision to continue service to the United States, it has been extraordinarily painful to endure these many months of false accusations of treason and other outrageous acts. Such false accusations are contrary to everything I've ever stood for, but I recognize the actions I acknowledged in court today were wrong, and through my faith in God, I am working to set things right. My guilty plea and agreement to cooperate with the special counsel's office reflect a decision I made in the best interest of my family and of our country. I accept full responsibility for my actions. Max Kuttner is here to help us understand all of this in this latest earthquake in the Mueller probe. He's senior politics writer at Newsweek, where he leads coverage of the FBI, the Department of Justice, and the Russia investigations. Max, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We're also going to get some legal perspective from Jennifer Rogers. She's executive director of the Center for the Advancement of Public Integrity at Columbia Law School and a former federal prosecutor herself. Jennifer, glad you're here.
Thanks.
Max, let me start with you, because you heard in Michael Flynn's statement after the rejection of charges of treason and sort of a burnishing of his military career there, that he is cooperating with the special counsel's office, that he's made that decision. The possibility of charges, Max, against Michael Flynn had been known for some time. So what's more critical to you here? Is it the guilty plea, the plea to a felony, or the fact that Michael Flynn appears to be cooperating fully with Robert Mueller now?
Well, I think what you just said is that he is cooperating is very significant. But I think also the details of this is significant. It's not just that he lied, but it's what he lied about. And this is something that we're seeing Democrats start to talk about, including Senator Dianne Feinstein, who is the ranking member on the Senate Judiciary Committee. She's brought this to light, that basically this shows that Mike Flynn was working on behalf of the Trump administration, talking to a foreign power before Trump was in office, which appears to be a violation of what's called the Logan Act. So it's the details here, not just the fact that he lied. And that's similar to what we saw with the charge against George Papadopoulos exactly a month ago or a little more than a month ago. It's not just that he made these false statements in the investigation. It's all the other details, what he was doing.
So Jennifer, Max says it's the details surrounding the lie in question that are important. But as a former prosecutor yourself, what do you see when you see someone like Michael Flynn plead guilty to a relatively narrow charge, given how broad Mueller's investigation appears to be?
Well, it's really interesting because prosecutors approach cooperating witnesses in different ways. Some offices, like my old office, require cooperators to plead guilty to all of their criminal conduct. Other prosecutors don't require that. So the fact that Flynn has pleaded guilty to one false statement charge doesn't necessarily tell us the whole universe of criminal acts that he has committed. It actually would tell us that if he were charged in the Southern District, but he's not. So it's not really clear what they have on him. I mean, what watchers who want to see this investigation ensnare the president want to see is a charge of something related to the interference, a conspiracy to hack into the emails or to interfere with the election processes or something that's actually criminally chargeable. And so we don't yet know from today's events whether they have that or whether they're close to getting it. We do know that he's on board, and that means that he will provide them with everything that he knows. And also, they wouldn't sign him up if he didn't have information that is valuable to them in a prosecution or investigation of others. So what he has certainly will help them move the ball. The question is where.
The question is where, and Jennifer, give us a sense, if you can, and Max, I'll talk to you about this too, of the universes, the sort of intersecting spheres that investigators might be concerned about here. Certainly his interactions with Russians, that's stipulated because he was charged for that. There were also questions about Michael Flynn not disclosing his foreign lobbying status. He's not charged with that, but we know now that he was accepting money from the government of Turkey, that he didn't disclose those payments, and there may be questions in that universe as well.
You may see that come back in additional charges. I would be surprised, though, because certainly the registration charges are pretty easy, kind of ready to go. So I suspect that they won't charge him with that. And I'm not sure why that would be, unless they just feel like the one false statements count is enough. But certainly they will explore as much as they can who else was involved in terms of the Russia investigation. I mean, he indicated today that his contacts were directed by campaign officials. So, of course, the Mueller team now knows who those officials are from Mike Flynn. So they'll be exploring that further and seeing where they can bring charges there. The whole Turkey side of things is yet to be fleshed out. There was reporting that he had even talked about essentially a kidnapping rendition plot. That is currently uncharged, so we'll see where that goes. But those are kind of the universes. You know, he won't have any real information on the obstruction case because, of course, it was about interference with Comey's investigation and, about Flynn basically being under investigation. So Flynn is unlikely to have valuable information there.
So, Max, Jennifer is saying we essentially, of course, have two sides of this investigation. Let's not forget. There's the criminal side, potential obstruction of justice, illegal things. Michael Flynn has been charged with an illegal thing, a crime, lying to the FBI. There's also a counterintelligence side of his investigation. Are both of those things important here? If investigators want to know who ordered Flynn to talk to the Russians, why he was doing it in the first place before he lied about it, it seems to me that could have implications on potentially both sides of this investigation.
Right. And I think the counterintelligence side is actually the more important side here. When we first heard on March 20 during a congressional testimony from James Comey that this investigation was underway, Comey described it as a counterintelligence investigation. He said it could go in a criminal direction if necessary, but it really was counterintelligence. And that is the investigation that Robert Mueller was chosen to oversee. So I think they're less concerned with kind of these crimes like making a false statement. And really the thing to think about here is counterintelligence, which means whether foreign powers, you know, were spying, were seeking information, what they got, if they got anyone and any Americans involved, what they know, how we can prevent them from knowing more.
And whether certainly when Michael Flynn talked to Russians before the inauguration or after, certainly before, whether he was told to do it potentially by the candidate, by the later president, Donald Trump himself.
Right. I think that's going to really be a major thing here today. And we're already seeing just moments ago the Trump administration or at least Trump's lawyer, Ty Cobb, trying to distance themselves from this the way that they tried to distance themselves from the previous charges. And you have his lawyer, Ty Cobb, saying Flynn was only in the White House for 25 days. Cobb even called Flynn an Obama official.
Distancing himself from the statements. And I'll read a little bit more of Ty Cobb's statement here. The false statements involved mere false statements to the White House, to officials that resulted in the resignation in the first place, basically saying, Jennifer, there's nothing new to see here. Michael Flynn got in trouble for the things we already knew he was in trouble for. But Jennifer, what would the president be worried about now, knowing that his former national security advisor has pledged what he calls full cooperation with investigators?
Well, he's certainly worried about what Mike Flynn is telling those investigators. I mean, we already know that he's told investigators that the that his contacts were directed by campaign officials. I read earlier today, and I don't know if this was part of Mike Flynn's statement, but that the president himself knew of these contacts. That would be completely contrary to what the president has been saying publicly all along. So if Mike Flynn is in fact prepared to testify that others directed him to make those contacts and it wasn't him initiating them, and frankly that the president knew about these overtures and these contacts, that would be blockbuster news that would completely contradict what the president has been saying. Now, it won't necessarily mean that the president is chargeable with anything, but politically it would be quite the bombshell.
Yeah, counterintelligence bombshells tend to have political ramifications, probably not legal ones, for the president of the United States. Max Kuttner, you know, there was some news in Washington yesterday that surprisingly has been buried behind all of this. And that's that over the summer, the president was busy calling up, meeting in person on Air Force One and elsewhere with Republican members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, another committee that's investigating possible nexus between Russia and the Trump campaign, basically to tell them to back off, asking the chairman, Richard Burr, to back off, other senators as well. Put that into some context of what we're seeing today when the chief executive is calling up legislators and trying to shut down an investigation.
Right. Well, we had already heard that Trump had asked people to shut down these investigations. James Comey testified to as much previously before Congress. I think this is a really big deal that he was getting involved in the congressional probes this way. So now we know that he was attempting to shut down not only the FBI and Justice Department and special counsel probe, but also the congressional probes. And that makes you question what we're hearing from Republicans in Congress when they're saying and I've been speaking with them in recent weeks, and they said, we haven't seen a single shred of evidence of collusion. We want to get this thing wrapped up very quickly. Democrats have been complaining to me about how quickly the Republicans are making them move, because as the majority party, the Republicans are the one who do set things like scheduling and issuing of subpoenas and things like that. So I think this is huge news. At the same time, the fact that the investigations are still going, I think, is a good thing. So if these conversations about shutting them down happened months ago, clearly, those requests were not taken very seriously, at least as we could see so far.
And back at the White House, as I let you two go, it's not just Michael Flynn. There are others in the White House orbit who are now going to be looking around as well, including Jared Kushner, Don Jr., Max Kuttner with Newsweek. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Jennifer Rogers with Columbia, former federal prosecutor. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Well, there's news in Washington, D.C. Michael Flynn pleads guilty to felony charges, all part of the Robert Mueller investigation. Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Meanwhile, over on Capitol Hill, they're achieving major news as well, but you probably won't hear about it on this day of massive bombshell revelations from the Mueller investigation. But Senate Republicans now say they have the votes to pass their massive tax cut bill. This development comes after concerns last night from some fiscally conservative Republicans that that bill would add $1 trillion to the deficit over a decade, even after factoring in the economic growth that Republicans say would come from these tax cuts. The Senate version of this bill cuts the corporate tax rates and taxes for families and individuals until 2025, some of them at least. It also eliminates the alternative minimum tax, a handful of other tax benefits, and fewer people would be subject to the estate tax. That's the tax on wealthy households when people die and pass on their riches to the young. Also notable, it repeals the individual mandate from the Affordable Care Act. That's been a cornerstone of the Affordable Care Act. Joining us with more on this bill and how Senate Republicans are going to resolve some of their differences between themselves and the House is Laura Davison, congressional reporter with Bloomberg Tax. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Well, Laura, Republicans say they have the 50 votes they need now, but take me back to last night, because there was some drama, and I'll call it Senate drama, on the floor during a tax vote where a handful of Republicans were holding back on their votes and threatening to sink this tax bill. What happened?
Yes. Yeah, so there were three senators in particular, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, Jeff Flake of Arizona, and Bob Corker of Tennessee, who were saying, look, we're concerned with this process. We're concerned that some of the issues we've been raising for weeks have not been addressed, and basically threatened to derail the whole process. Ultimately, they got to a yes, and the process moved forward. And at least two out of those three have said, yes, we will vote for the bill. So for Ron Johnson, he wanted more money for small businesses, what's known as pass-throughs, which can really be anything from a small mom-and-pop store really up to big private equity hedge fund, that sort of thing. So he got more money overnight, and he came out this morning and said, thumbs up, he's in for the bill. Flake and Corker were the ones with deficit concerns, and Corker really being the most strident. He has been talking for months about how he doesn't want to vote for a bill that will add one penny to the deficit. And it looks that he's really lost his battle. Leadership was able to get Flake to vote for the bill. He got some concessions saying that they'll work on immigration issues, that deferred action for childhood arrivals, something that's important to him and his state of Arizona. He also got a little bit of tweaks on the budget, just sort of kind of some small technical things that he said, okay, he can vote for it. But Corker is really the one holdout. And with the margins that they have in the Senate, they can afford to lose two senators. He's one of those that has yet to come out, and he doesn't really have any leverage left. And, he can vote no, but the bill can still pass. And it will, according to scores that we've seen, add to the deficit somewhere, maybe to the tune of about $1 trillion over a decade.
Yeah. So, Laura, if Jeff Flake said he didn't want to vote for a bill that added one penny to the deficit, what's a trillion times a penny times 100? That's 100 trillion pennies that he's going to add to the deficit here. And I say that because Republican concerns over exploding the deficit resulted in a lot of drama last night for Republicans, a couple of Republicans trying to make some move, some nods to the old Republican thinking that exploding debt was a bad idea. And that seems to have gone by the wayside.
That's true. That has very much not been at the center of this debate. Republicans say that their tax plan will pay for itself, that economic growth will be so strong that businesses will be doing so well, but they'll be paying more in tax, and that this won't matter. However, we haven't really seen the data yet to back it up. This plan cost about $1.4 trillion. About $400 billion of that will be paid for, so about a third. There's some other scores from other estimates from groups that are maybe a little bit less credible. For example, the Koch brothers funded a study that said this will, raise revenues by $1 trillion, which is a lot more than what the, kind of the scorekeepers within Congress are saying.
And now, once this bill passes in the Senate, it looks like it will. It's on to negotiations with the House. Before we let you go, Laura, what are the main sticking points between the House and the Senate?
So one main issue is the state and local tax deduction. This is really important to high tax states like New York and New Jersey. So in the House, they came up with a compromise to allow for $10,000 of property tax deductions. You no longer can deduct your income taxes. The Senate bill fully gets rid of that state and local deduction. But Susan Collins of Maine, one of the things that they've done to try to get her on board is to have it mirror the House. So if that happens, it's really quite smooth sailing going forward. There are some small issues, some things that are in the Senate bill but not in the House bill. Issues like the mortgage interest deduction is kept at a $1 million cap in the Senate, only $500,000 in the House. That'll have to be worked out. Things like some of the tax benefits for graduate students, medical expense deduction in the Senate bill, not in the House bill. So basically what they'll have to do is run the numbers, see what they have the money to allow for based on kind of the Senate rules, which they can lose a bunch of money in the first decade, but they can't lose any money. It can't add to the deficit after a decade. So they've got to work all of that through. But they're hoping to pass it by the end of the year. And based on the timeline and based on the agreements we've seen this morning, that is very much a reality.
In Washington, felony charges on one side of town in the Mueller investigation. On the other side of town, impending victory for Republicans cutting taxes in Congress. Laura Davison with Bloomberg Tax. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us on this Friday Takeaway. Today, I'm Todd Zwillick, and this week, there's been more turmoil at the State Department. President Donald Trump and his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, really don't get along. Now, that's not new. What is new is that on Thursday, the New York Times reported that White House Chief of Staff John Kelly has developed a plan to replace Rex Tillerson at State and put in his place CIA Director Mike Pompeo. Listen to White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders and State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert here back to back.
I think his future right now is to continue working hard as the Secretary of State, continue working with the President to carry out his agenda.
The White House statement confirmed that there will be no personnel changes. It is a fact that Secretary Tillerson serves at the pleasure of the President, as we all do, as does every political appointee and cabinet member.
Sufficiently ambiguous statements there from the White House and from Foggy Bottom. To hear career officials at the State Department tell it, they won't be sorry to see Rex Tillerson go if, in fact, he does. Tillerson, in his brief tenure, has brought them a hiring freeze, a proposed 30% budget cut, and a rapid loss of senior personnel. Daniel Benjamin served as ambassador at large and coordinator for counterterrorism at the State Department. He was the principal counterterrorism advisor to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. He's now a professor at Dartmouth. Daniel Benjamin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Ambassador, the White House has not confirmed that Rex Tillerson is going, but they haven't denied it either. Why is Tillerson apparently out here? What are you hearing?
The relationship between the president and Secretary of State never really took off. There's been a whole series of clashes and in particular cases in which the president has undermined the secretary. The secretary has tried to do things that resemble normal diplomacy and trying to calm down, for example, the feud between the Saudis and the Qataris in one case, or trying to start diplomacy with North Korea. And the president has undercut him by, in particular, tweeting things like, Rex, don't waste your time on diplomacy on the Korean Peninsula. Then there was the episode where it was leaked that the secretary, I think, had referred to the president as a moron. Doesn't usually help your relationship with your boss. And so it seems like this relationship has been in a downward spiral for quite some time.
All right. So enough palace intrigue at the State Department. Let's talk about the real world. How do other countries see a shakeup like this? Do they just wait it out, or do they perceive a real weakness in American diplomacy if Rex Tillerson is gone less than a year into the administration and is replaced with someone else?
Most of our diplomatic partners around the world, I think, will look at this as a confirmation of what they have thought to be the case all along, which is that the State Department and the Secretary of State in particular is not someone who is really empowered to speak for the United States government. I don't think there will be any particular nostalgia, any warm feelings for Tillerson, who hasn't been a terribly active Secretary of State and really has spent much more time closeted on the seventh floor of the department working on his reorganization of the department. But, you know, this news was leaked yesterday, the day before Tillerson takes off for a trip to Europe. And I'm sure that his European interlocutors are viewing this as kind of a charade. Why are they talking to this guy if he doesn't speak for the U.S. government? And that undermines American diplomacy in a pretty serious way.
Meanwhile, back at State Department headquarters in Washington, D.C., Ambassador, reports of a mass exodus of career professionals and officials either fired, relieved, or retiring due to Rex Tillerson's reorganization plan that you mentioned, the ranks of senior level officials thinned out. What's the effect here in the department?
Well, the effect is very, very serious and very damaging. To have your senior leadership largely decapitated in a manner like that is hugely demoralizing. And equally important, we're losing absolutely invaluable stores of knowledge and diplomatic capacity. And that is going to make it very difficult for the U.S. to negotiate the deals it wants, the arrangements it wants around the world.
Can you give a little bit more of a detailed picture of what the upper ranks of Foreign Service officials look like, including ambassadors, unfilled ambassador seats in American embassies around the world?
So to begin with, there are something like 75 senior positions in the department that have not been filled, and I believe that doesn't count the embassies. We do not have an ambassador, for example, in South Korea. We do not have an assistant secretary of state for East Asian affairs. So the whole notion of creating a diplomatic game plan for dealing with the North Korean nuclear issue is kind of silly. I mean, to the extent that there is any plan and that we're not just reacting, it's being created without the input of the most senior, most experienced diplomats that we have. You know, it's a little like trying to plan your global security policies without having, you know, half of your generals.
Well, let's give Rex Tillerson his say here and hear from him on the whole notion of the upper ranks of the State Department being hollowed out.
I read these articles that there's this hollowing out. I take offense to that on their behalf, because the people that are serving in those roles are doing extraordinary work.
Daniel Benjamin, the Secretary of State, is offended on behalf of the Foreign Service and the senior members of the State Department.
Right. And it's like that scene in Casablanca. I'm shocked. I'm shocked that there's gambling going on in the casino. He may be offended, but he and his minions haven't hesitated to very peremptorily simply show the door to some of our senior most diplomats, including, you know, asking people if they could be out of the building in a day or two. So, you know, I have to say this is not a very serious statement by the nation's top diplomat.
Ambassador Daniel Benjamin, what would it take to hire these people back eventually if someone decides to sort of restock the State Department? I mean, a lot of these jobs are mandated by Congress, right? They might be open seats left unfilled. Can't a new Secretary of State just go on a hiring binge?
In theory, a new Secretary of State, with the agreement of the president and with the assent of Congress, which will have to confirm lots of these people, could bring them back as political appointees. But I think that, you know, these are extremely talented people who, for the most part, will have very good prospects in the private sector. And so I would say, at a minimum, restocking the department is going to be a 10-year project. And if the eliminations, if the firings continue and the demoralization continues, it could wind up being a much longer project.
Daniel Benjamin, former ambassador at large and counterterrorism coordinator at the State Department. Ambassador, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
After I spoke with Daniel earlier today, Rex Tillerson responded to the reports detailing his imminent departure. He called them laughable, but he offered no other comment besides that. We'll keep following this story at the State Department as it develops. The man implicated in the death of Catherine Steinle in 2015 has been found not guilty of murder and manslaughter. A San Francisco jury acquitted Jose Inez Garcia Zarate of the charges yesterday, but the reaction has been fierce. President Trump and his conservative base made Steinle's death an immigration rallying cry, from the GOP convention in the summer all the way to the House Republican agenda this year. Kay Steinle was shot in San Francisco, and Zarate fired that shot. He's an undocumented immigrant, and at the time of Steinle's death, Zarate had been deported back to Mexico at least 5 times, coming back illegally into the United States each time. Marisa Lagos is the politics and government reporter for KQED in San Francisco. She's been following this story for months. Marisa, thanks for coming back.
My pleasure.
This verdict, an acquittal for Zarate in this closely watched trial. How did jurors reach a not guilty verdict?
We don't know exactly what the jury thought. They left without talking to the press or the public, and their names are not public. But it seems like they probably bought the defense attorney's argument, which was basically that Garcia Zarate, who had been homeless for a few months, was wandering around the waterfront and found something under a chair. And when he picked it up, they say it accidentally went off. It is interesting, though, that they found him not guilty of the murder and manslaughter charges, but did find him guilty of being a felon in possession of a gun, because that does contradict that argument a little bit if it was an accidental thing that he picked this up for a moment. But, you know, it was a really kind of clear case. The prosecution was arguing for first degree murder. They said this was intentional, even though the bullet hit the pier before it hit Kate Steinle, and the defense attorneys really just hammered home this point that you know, this guy didn't have a criminal past. He didn't have any reason to target Kate Steinle. And they showed some video that they said showed somebody possibly leaving the gun under that chair where he apparently found it.
So there's a real disconnect between the cause on the right behind Kate Steinle's death and demands for immigration reform, keeping people like Garcia Zarate out of the country, and the facts that the jurors in this case heard, right? I mean, you mentioned it, not only a gun found under a chair they heard, but a bullet that ricocheted before it tragically struck Kate Steinle.
And that's kind of been the fascinating thing. And actually, Todd, you and I have discussed this before this case started, which is that the sort of courtroom case was not about immigration, whereas the national conversation is all about immigration. And so I think that, you know, to be fair, both the prosecutors and the defense attorneys really worked hard to keep that immigration argument and conversation out of the courtroom. But I think that that might make it a little harder for folks who didn't get a chance to sit in there and hear, you know, what was said during this trial to understand. Because the bottom line is, for the prosecution, the fact that this man was an undocumented immigrant had nothing to do with their case.
And not only the Republican case about border security and president's demand to build a wall, but San Francisco's status as a sanctuary city. San Francisco is a place that a person like Garcia Zarate, if he's picked up by local authorities, they wouldn't call the feds on him.
No, and I mean, that sort of goes to the heart of this whole argument about, you know, undocumented immigrants and sanctuary cities, which is something that I've been reporting on for months, which is how much more complicated this story is than President Trump and Attorney General Jeff Sessions and other critics of San Francisco would have you believe. Garcia Zarate had reentered the United States illegally at least 5 times, but he got caught every time and he spent time in federal prison. And right before he was sent to San Francisco, he was in a federal prison serving a sentence. The feds are the ones that picked up the phone and called San Francisco and asked if they wanted him for a 20-year-old marijuana charge. And, you know, they sent him here well knowing that San Francisco had a sanctuary policy on the books for 2 decades. So there's a lot of real sort of, I think, big nuance to this case that often gets lost. Another thing I always have to point out is where that gun came from. We don't know exactly how, you know, it ended up on the pier to this day, but we do know that someone stole it out of the car of a federal park ranger. A federal police officer left it in their car in San Francisco and it got stolen. And I do think that if this were a different moment, that might be the story we would be talking about, not the immigration status of the defendant.
Well, Marisa, if you're steeped in national politics or if you spend your evenings watching Fox News, you're expecting, in fact, you know, there's going to be a massive backlash after this verdict. The president himself tweeted that the jury verdict was a complete travesty of justice. The White House press secretary has been tweeting about it. Contrast that with the atmosphere within the bounds of San Francisco. Are people there as worried about the immigration implications of this case as national conservatives are?
In a word, no. I mean, I think you're going to get a very mixed reaction if you go out on the streets of San Francisco today and talk to people about this. You know, a young woman is dead who had her whole life in front of her, and there's no kind of taking away from the tragic nature of Catherine Steinle's death, but I don't think most people here view it in the same prism. The only sort of response we've seen public call out has been a memorial on the pier where Steinle was shot, but no protests in the street. And, you know, interestingly, after Garcia Zarate was released from jail here a few months before the shooting, and he was released without them calling Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And that did prompt some soul searching in San Francisco and some long conversations about whether or not the law needed to be changed. And ultimately, a year later, they ended up strengthening it on the side of protecting undocumented immigrants, not making it easier to hand them over to ICE. So I think, you know, within San Francisco, there is not a political will to change this. You know, California is a huge state. There's a lot of diversity from the coast to the rural areas. I think this could play more maybe in the governor's race next year. We have a U.S. Senate race coming up. But, you know, it's not going to be the same as what you're hearing, yeah, on Fox News by any means in California.
Meanwhile, federal immigration authorities were quick to announce last night, before we let you go, Marisa, that Garcia Zarate will again be deported, and quickly.
Yep, no surprise there. I mean, they've been wanting to deport him since this happened. I did also see some reports that the Justice Department might try to actually charge him with a new crime of illegal reentry or something else. I'm not sure how they would do that because he's already served his time for the last one. But certainly once he serves whatever sentence he gets for this gun charge, the feds will be waiting at the door to pick him up this time.
A San Francisco jury is finished with the case of the tragic death of Kate Steinle. The national media and national Republicans are not finished with it. You'll be hearing a lot more about Kate Steinle. Marisa Lagos with KQED, thanks for coming back.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Michael?
Yeah?
Who are the goblins?
Put that cookie down now!
How did it get burned? How did it get burned?
I don't know!
Hello there.
Your stupid minds! Stupid! Stupid!
No one laughs at a master of quack fool!
You're tearing me apart, Lisa!
What was that, a bad movies montage, guys? Is that what that was? Control Room says, yes, that is a Bad Movies montage. I think in art in honor of The Room, which is at the basis of one of our films today, The Disaster Artist with Rafer Guzman. Hi, Rafer.
Hi, Todd.
You've seen The Room, right? The classically bad movie.
Indeed, I have.
Oh, it's so good. It is the worst movie ever made, which is why they flock to the theater one midnight per month here in Washington, D.C. to watch it. Rafer Guzman is film critic with Newsday and The Takeaway. Rafer, The Disaster Artist is our first film up. This is James Franco. As I said, this is all about the best, bad, worst movie ever made in history, sort of a biopic about that film. Listen to a clip here from The Disaster Artist.
Why you bring me here?
Well, what do you mean?
Scene partner. That job?
No, not at all.
Then what, Greg? I don't see point.
When I get up on stage in front of people, it's like all I can think about is what if they laugh at me or if I embarrass myself.
Mm-hmm.
But you, man, you're like fearless, and I want to feel that too.
Rafer, do people need to go and see The Room before they run and see The Disaster Artist, all about the making of The Room?
It's so funny. People ask me that a lot. Do I need to sit through The Room before I see this film? I would say I'm going to give you a pass. I really don't think you do. I think you get a pretty good sense from watching this movie about just how bad and weird that film is. And really the draw here is James Franco playing Tommy Wiseau, this really one of the weirder people in Hollywood, which is saying a lot. A strange guy with this sort of mysterious accent. You could kind of hear it there in that clip. Is he Polish? Is he from Beijing? Is he from New Orleans? Where is he from? A mystery to this day, so no one still knows. But it's a great performance, very funny. And I think what I like about this film is it has a generosity of spirit. I think it is, in a way, although it's poking fun at Wiseau, it's also saying, hey, you did this thing. People go see it. That's what the movies are about. In that sense, it's a success.
Also, Tommy Wiseau, a fearless artist, and I haven't seen the film yet, but one of the things I've gleaned from some of the writing about it is really a story about a person who didn't really care what people thought about him, just wanted his art out there, and he was fearless about it.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and I think that's what draws him to Greg Sestero, who's one of the characters in the film, an actor played by Dave Franco. And this is based on Greg Sestero's book, which I found like a really touching and actually really great memoir about this friendship and about what a character and about how inspirational Wiseau was, even though his masterpiece became kind of a laughingstock in the end.
And I will say, if you are a fan of good, bad film, a theater near you probably shows The Room. Get it on Netflix. You got to watch that movie. It's truly bad, but a heartwarming story in The Disaster Artist. Rafer, you have The Shape of Water here from director Guillermo del Toro. Let's listen.
When he looks at me, he doesn't know how I am incomplete. He sees me as I am.
This is The Shape of Water. Rafer, I'm hearing a fairy tale, I think.
Yeah, that's Richard Jenkins, who is narrating there, because the person he's talking to, or the person who's speaking to him, played by Sally Hawkins, is mute, and so she's speaking to him in sign language. She plays a woman who is a cleaning woman at a government facility, and they have a creature of some sort of a black lagoon, kind of humanoid, fishy creature that arrives in the facility, and unexpectedly, she falls in love with it. And this is, I think, Guillermo del Toro's attempt to update the monster movie, specifically Creature from the Black Lagoon, for a new era, not just in the effects, which are extraordinary, but in sort of the morality of the tale. You know, instead of the men going off to rescue the woman who's been kidnapped by the monster, it's the other way around. She wants to be with the monster. She wants to fall in love with him. But Michael Shannon plays a guy at the facility who is trying to keep them apart. And I think that's a pretty interesting take on the monster movie today.
Also set, interestingly, right in the heart of the Cold War in 1962.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there is something about the fact that Michael Shannon plays this very hard-nosed, strict, all-American male, this very intolerant, intransigent character that seems important to me. And I think there's also, I think, a little bit of a thematic thread that Richard Jenkins' character is gay. And so I think there is something about this kind of expansive definition of love, if you will, in this movie that I think is interesting.
That's The Shape of Water. Rafer Guzman sending you out to the movies this weekend. Rafer, thanks.
Thanks, Todd.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. We've spent all this week looking at the state and the future of the Democratic Party. Next week, it's the GOP. You'll hear from Republicans inside and outside of Washington on whether their party can survive their leader. President Donald Trump. But for now, back to the Dems. We've heard the stats. Over 1,000 seats lost nationwide since 2009, more registered independents than Democrats, and the loss of control of the White House, the House, and the Senate. So the big question now for Democrats, how to rebuild? Well, part of this fight, the future of the Democratic Party, is happening within the Democratic National Committee itself. A group called the Unity Reform Commission is trying to hash out some of the big issues: how to handle primaries, who should handle the money, and what to do about those superdelegates. The Democratic Party has factions, and those factions all have places on this commission. They meet next week for the final time. Representatives of the establishment Hillary Clinton wing of the Democratic Party, the progressive pro-Bernie forces, and appointees installed by DNC Chairman Tom Perez. We have a Clinton appointee and a Sanders appointee from the middle of this fight here today. First up, Jorge Neri. He was Nevada State Director for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. And Neri says he's optimistic about changes in the party.
I think that under the leadership of Tom Perez and Keith Ellison, being able to really make the party diverse, you know, it's my goal to make sure that Tom Perez is successful as a Latino that is running the DNC, making sure that we're doing things better and that we're being more inclusive and that we're helping folks that maybe don't understand the process really be part of it.
So let's go inside the Unity Commission for just a second. It is an insider's fight. But it seems to me the fundamental question here is a lot of Bernie supporters are saying that if they don't see a Democratic Party that fundamentally reforms how open it is to progressives, they may bolt the whole circus altogether. They may just get out of the Democratic Party and stay independent, stay outsiders. Is that a risk?
You know, I think sometimes we get caught up in the nitty-gritty of what the DNC is or these the specific rule. I think it's very easy to criticize the Democratic Party. It's very easy to say Tom Perez maybe isn't doing a good job, but I think that that's wrong, because our job as the Unity Reform Commission is to help support it, to help fix it, and to find solutions. And making sure that we're finding these solutions is what I want, because what's at stake is, you know, really the future of our country, the future of the issues that I've fought for that affect everyday Americans.
Well, I think it's true that voters don't care much what goes on inside the Democratic Party with fights on one commission or another. But there are a lot of Democratic voters out there, or people who could be Democratic voters, Jorge, and you know this, who think the primary was rigged. That's a problem that the Democratic coalition has, which is fundamental fairness. Do you worry about that spirit, whether people feel dealt in?
Ultimately, I think the big focus is making sure that we're explaining people what the process is. And I think that's what we could have done a better job at. You know, you have a lot of people that have been on the, you know, DNC members for years and years and years. What are they doing to build a bench? What are they doing to make sure that, you know, at some point they step aside and have another person come in, that we're continuing to make sure that folks are diverse and, you know, come from all different backgrounds in different states? You know, that's really been what I've been pushing on the Unity Reform Commission.
Well, Jorge, I know you're positive about your party's future, and I know that the Unity Commission is working toward unity. But when you turn the light out at night and you think about the future of this party, what worries you? What's the big problem?
I think we've been playing by a set of rules for a long time. And I think what you've seen in some of these, like the Russian hacking, the ad buys on Facebook, and the attacks, the cyber attacks that have been happening on campaigns, things like that, that's the stuff that I think that you can't really account for. And I think, you know, we can raise money, we can come up with a good program, we could contrast each other on messaging. But when you have these outside influencers really messing with things, I think that's what worries me.
Jorge Neri, Nevada State Director for Hillary 2016. Jorge, I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We go now to a Sanders appointee on the Unity Commission who does not have an optimistic view of a party she says is riddled with corruption. Nomiki Konst was a national surrogate for the Sanders presidential campaign. She sits on that Unity Reform Commission. She paints a picture of a Democratic Party teetering on the brink of survival.
it's not about Bernie versus Hillary anymore. I know it's easy for people in the media, and if you're not following the internal debates of the Democratic Party, I think it's about people who are willing to reform the party and folks, and it's a minority, but they're a very vocal minority, who are reluctant to change the way because they'll lose power. Folks who understand the real issues facing the party, understand that we're bleeding membership, the Democratic Party is broke, state parties, you know, where you recruit candidates. That's also where the message is spread. Those parties don't have money right now. So if we want to exist, we have to reform. Those who are reluctant to do so, I would question what their interests are.
So we've heard about some of the proposals coming from your side, but I want to play for you a cut from Howard Dean, former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, who was on this show earlier this week, talking about this fight that you're a part of inside the party. Listen.
I think that fighting inside the DNC is a waste of time. It's a waste of everybody's time. And what I say to everybody is get with the program. So let's democratize the party, not as a part of the Hillary versus Bernie fight, which I wish would people would shut up, because we got to look towards 2020 and 2018 and not backwards.
I don't know how we can reform the party without actually discussing the reforms. And right now, with so many people fleeing the Democratic Party, with Democratic Socialists of America having record registration, it's insane to me to see the crisis is whether or not it will be able to exist and fight in 2020 and 2018. You cannot win if you don't have state parties funded. So Chairman Dean, I agree, democratize the party, but democratize it for the people, not the lobbyists. I mean, the majority, half of the members of the DNC right now are lobbyists and consultants. Is that democratization?
So how are we going to know this time next week when the Unity Commission is done with its deliberations, whether the inevitable statement of unity, which I'm expecting, will be real, and whether you and your cohorts from the progressive wing of the party are going to stay?
Well, we have our last meeting on December 8th. I think that we're most likely going to make a strong statement no matter what. I'm hoping that I have no doubt that we're going to reform superdelegates. We have a mandate to do so. There's no doubt about it. Will they be eliminated? I'm not sure. Primaries in states like New York, I have a strong feeling that we're going to submit to the New York Democratic Party for them to open up their primary. Reforming the caucus process. I think the real issue right now that's holding up the party is the internal reform. Is there going to be a ban of conflicts of interests in the Democratic Party? Are we going to have some accountability over the budget? We're not saying open the budget up for the public. We're saying open it up to your board, your executive committee. That's called good governance. We have to make the Democratic Party a party of good governance once again. It's not just about being democratic. It's about practicing what you preach.
Nomiki Konst, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Nomiki Konst is a member of the DNC's Unity Reform Commission and a former national surrogate for the Bernie Sanders campaign. You can listen back to all of my interviews, including some extended conversations. Nomiki Konst, Howard Dean, Bernie Sanders, all on the future of the Democratic Party. It's on our website at thetakeaway.org. Next week, it's the Republicans.
Where are we now? Where are we now?
This is the battle the party eventually has to have with itself. On paper, the Republican Party has never been in better shape than it is right now. And yet, you can certainly argue that the Republican Party is at a lowest point that it has ever been. I would only argue against that, saying, I think we've got a ways to go, and Roy Moore is a symptom of that.
That's Doug High. He's a veteran of the Republican establishment. Next week, you'll hear more from Doug and others inside and definitely outside the GOP establishment. Republicans, you're part of this conversation. Tell us your vision of the Republican Party. Call us. Be part of it. 877-8-MY-TAKE is the number. That's next week. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great weekend. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Where are we now? Where are we now?
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.